This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thank you all so much for coming. Still feels very special to be able to sit in a group in a temple. It's really nice to be here with friends, with our Sangha, especially with so many difficult things going on in the world. Temples of, you know, all denominations have often been sort of a place of refuge. And we use that word a lot in Buddhism, refuge. We talk about taking refuge in Buddha, the enlightened teacher, taking refuge in Dharma, the teachings, and taking refuge in Sangha, our community of practitioners. But sometimes it can feel wrong to be at a temple at a time like this. And I remember, I guess nearly 2 years ago, after the killing of George Floyd, I was asked by a reporter whether meditation at a time like that was immoral. And it can feel that way. It can feel like hiding or turning away. But my feeling, and what I said then, is that I really believe that meditation is the opposite. Meditation is the practice of not turning away, of facing whatever comes, of paying complete attention to whatever is happening in this moment. Many of you have heard me talk about mindfulness, a word that's often used to describe this style of paying attention. And in English, it can sound like sort of a fancy word. It's not a word that was very much used in English until a couple of decades ago. But in Pali, in the language of the Buddha, it wasn't a fancy word at all. It was just this very simple word, sati. The same word that's used to mean remembering. And it really is just this very simple, basic practice of remembering the present. And we use meditation as a way of practicing that, of practicing paying attention to the present. We limit our distractions. We find somewhere quiet and peaceful, like the Zendo. And we just practice paying attention to whatever comes. And that's what we've been doing this morning together. As most of you know, Buddha started his life as a prince, and his parents tried to shelter him from all hardship, not just horrible hardship like war, but they didn't even allow him to associate with anyone who was unhappy. But he rejected this approach of hiding away. And not just because it felt immoral, perhaps, to live like that, but also because it was ineffective. It didn't help anyone to run away from suffering, not even himself. And so next, he famously tried the opposite, running towards suffering, trying to invite as much suffering as he possibly could. And this didn't work either. What did work in the end was finding balance, neither courting suffering nor avoiding it. What he called his middle way. People sometimes think this sounds very passive, just taking what comes. But I don't think that's quite right for a couple reasons. First, just very simply, I'm not sure what the alternative is. The middle way is about living in reality. We accept reality in the sense that we don't deny it. We don't pretend that things are different than they are. And we don't waste time complaining. If bad things happen, we notice those bad things. We don't deny them. But we also don't waste time trying to wish them away. But second, we don't stop there. The middle way has many components. In Buddha's first lecture on the middle way, he described 8 parts of finding that middle way path. And one of these he called sammakammanta, right action. After we notice the world, after we see the world as it really is, we take action. We respond to the world. That can take many forms. For the most part, any sort of violence is discouraged. Although it's also true that every Buddhist country, starting from the first that was founded not long after Buddha lived, has had an army. And there are Buddhists serving in the US Armed Forces. So there is some point of disagreement on whether violence is ever appropriate. But I think all Buddhists agree that violence is not the only response and rarely the best response we can take. The law of karma suggests that all actions have consequences. Karma is sometimes used colloquially to mean sort of bad luck or something like that. But it really just means cause and effect. When we pay attention to karma, we realize, we see the effects not only of our own actions, but the actions of others. And we are both at the mercy of those consequences and sometimes the originator of those consequences. Thich Nhat Hanh, the great Vietnamese Zen master who passed away just over a month ago, he was probably the greatest proponent of this view. And in many ways, he broke a long tradition of Zen masters in America being mostly apolitical. If you read some of the other early books on Zen, including wonderful books like Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which collect talks given not far from here in the 1960s, there's almost no discussion of politics. I think no mention of war, which is sort of strange if you think about it, since that was probably very much on the minds of Suzuki Roshi students back then, and probably a topic that they talked about quite a bit. But he talked about it almost not at all. It's possible that this was a result of some embarrassment of the way Japanese Zen masters had responded to the Second World War. Many became strong supporters of their own nationalist government. And I know for myself, and I see this in others, if we've made a very bad decision, we're reluctant to make another decision at the risk of making another mistake. And so perhaps they retreated into a sort of apolitical stance to ensure that they never chose the wrong side again. But Thich Nhat Hanh was very political. The first books he wrote when he came to the West were really books of politics, not books about meditation. And yet he also understood that meditation could itself be a political act, that seeing clearly was a political act. But he wasn't the only one who understood this. This year on Martin Luther King's birthday, I spent some time reading King's writings. Dr. King was a friend, actually, of Thich Nhat Hanh's. And he was the first one to nominate Thich Nhat Hanh for the Nobel Peace Prize, long before Thich Nhat Hanh was at all famous. And I don't know if Dr. King meditated per se, but he certainly understood the importance of paying attention. And I found these lines in one of his letters. He was writing to a friend, I think a colleague in Boston, and explaining why he wanted to give himself one day a week for what he called reflection, which is similar to a concept Thich Nhat Hanh often talks about, of having a day of mindfulness each week. Dr. King wrote, "My failure to reflect will do harm, not only to me as a person, but to the total movement. For that reason, I feel a moral obligation to do it." I'll just read that again. "My failure to reflect will do harm, not only to me as a person, but to the total movement. For that reason, I feel a moral obligation to do it." And I suppose I feel the same way. Meditation is not just permissible in the face of great suffering. It is a moral obligation, because we have an obligation to see the world clearly, to face suffering head on. Meditation really is not hiding. It's the opposite of hiding. It's exposing ourselves to each moment exactly as it comes. Some of those moments will be joyous. Some of those moments will be very painful. But we face each one regardless. We've started to have some rain again in this area. So some of you have heard me talk about what happens in my neighborhood after the rains. That after these rains, lots of snails come out, fill up all the sidewalks. And so if you take a walk in my neighborhood after the rain, and if you're not paying attention, it's quite easy to step on a snail. And it's horrible, a terrible feeling if you've ever done it, which I have. And I think it's horrible because we know that we've, through our own clumsiness, we've caused suffering. We've taken this life of this helpless little being. Reason, really for no reason at all. And yet on the flip side, if we do pay attention, if we look where we're going and we see the snails, it's actually quite hard to step on one. It just immediately feels wrong. I mean, I'm not even sure I could make myself do it. Because again, once we've seen them, we don't want to cause them suffering. And so when we truly pay attention to the awful events unfolding in the world, of course we want to help. We want to do what we can to stop them. And that may take different forms for different people. Some may give money to the 1.5 million or more refugees that are now flooding Europe. Some may get more involved politically. Some will join protests. Maybe some even try to go to Ukraine to help. Right action will look different for each of us. But we can't do any of that without first paying attention, without first seeing the harm, seeing the suffering. So what exactly do we see when we pay attention? Well, I can't tell you what you'll see. I'm not even sure I can always describe what I see. But I can tell you what Buddha saw, because this is recorded in his lectures. He saw suffering, of course, lots of suffering, but not only suffering. He saw two other things that together with suffering, he called the three marks of all existence. The three things you see no matter where you look. In addition to suffering, he saw what he called impermanence and no self. Like suffering, impermanence is pretty easy to understand. Nothing lasts forever. Everything changes. No matter how bad things are, no matter how good things are, tomorrow will be different. The next moment will be different. Nothing stays the same. But no self is a bit harder to understand. It doesn't mean we don't exist. If we didn't exist, then killing wouldn't exist. War wouldn't exist. But it does. That's easy enough to see. What doesn't exist is a separate, unchanging self. I just talked about the unchanging part. We can't have an unchanging self because everything changes. But we also don't have a separate self. Because when we look closely, everything is connected. There's no sharp line marking where you end and the world begins. There's no sharp line between me and you. Like I'm sure many people, I spent a lot of the week reading about Ukraine, thinking about Ukraine. And then a strange thing happened. I think it was on Friday. I realized I was Ukrainian. And I don't mean this in like a metaphysical way, like that we're all Ukrainian. Although I suppose we are. But I suddenly remembered a conversation I had with my grandfather. It must have been 30 years ago, before my own kids were born, before I think even I was married. I knew that he had been born in Denver, but I knew nothing about his parents. I think they might have died either before my father was born or when he was very young. So he didn't seem to know much about them either. And so I asked my grandfather where his parents were from. And he told me they were from Ukraine. Or from this town that's now part of Ukraine. It's in this area of Europe that's moved around, where the borders have moved across it a few times. And I went and looked at a map and I remembered the town, Mukachevo, in the west of Ukraine. And I texted my dad to see if my memory was right. But it turned out he had actually never had that conversation, so he still didn't know where his grandparents were from, but he called his brother, my uncle, and his brother confirmed that I was right, that I have two great-grandparents from Ukraine. And of course, at some level, it doesn't really matter that these two ancestors, who I never met, were from that town. But somehow it brought home to me how connected we all are. That in that town right now, maybe there's someone whose great-grandparents knew my great-grandparents. Maybe there's even someone living in their old house, or at least on their old block. And who knows how many people there are connected to me. I suppose Buddha would say all of them. This business of seeing clearly isn't unique to Zen practice. I often think that seeing clearly is also what poets try to do. I'm not a poet myself, but some of our teachers here at Jikoji are poets, and I have friends who are poets. And so I asked an old friend whose parents were from Ukraine to recommend some Ukrainian poetry to me this week. I suppose I wanted to know what they see when they try to see clearly. And so I thought I would close with a poem from the poet he recommended, Oksana Zabushko. And it's called A Definition of Poetry. I know I'll die a difficult death, like anyone who loves the precise music of her own body, who knows how to force it through the gaps in fear and through a needle's eye, who has danced a lifetime with the body, every move of shoulders, back, and thighs, shimmering with mystery like a Sanskrit word. Muscles playing under the skin, like fish in a nocturnal pool. Thank you, Lord, for giving us bodies. When I die, tell the carpenters to take down the rafters and ceiling. They say my great-grandfather, a sorcerer, got out this way. When my body softens with moisture, the bloated soul, dark and bulging, will strain like a blue vein in a boiled egg white, and the body will ripple with spasms, like the blanket a sick man wrestles off because it's hot. And the soul will rise to break through the press of flesh, curse of gravity. The cosmos, above the black well of the room, will suck on its galactic tube, heaven breaking in a blistering starfall, and draw the soul up, trembling like a sheet of paper. My young soul, the color of wet grass, to freedom. Then stop, it screams, escaping. On the dazzling borderline between two worlds. Stop, wait. My God, at last. Look, here's where poetry comes from. Fingers twitching for the ballpoint, growing cold, becoming not mine. Thank you for taking some time today to try to see things clearly with me. I think we have a few minutes for questions. If anyone had something they wanted to ask or something to say. Thank you too to those of you joining us online. You're welcome to ask questions as well if anything's come up. Kaveh, did you have a question?
Yeah. First, I want to thank you for a beautiful, sensitive talk, timely talk. Second, the comment you made about the early Buddhist teachers, I was thinking, because I love Suzuki Roshi, and I was thinking, it's true he didn't talk about politics in Zen mind, beginner's mind, but I remember the anecdote his students related, you know, at that time the Vietnam War had started, it was, you know, it was raging, and his students were very angry, a lot of them very angry, and they wanted to go march and in an anti-war movement. And Roshi told them, the war is right here in the Zendo. The war is in right here in the Zendo, which I understand to mean that we bring that attitude when, you know, in this kind of angry time, the anger rises in us also in reaction to it. And trying to engage in peacemaking activity with anger inside just creates more of the same. So I don't know, you know, if it's possible not to be angry in the face of such injustice. And kids are, you know, everything that's going on, I'm not going to go through the enumeration of it that keeps going on in human history, but at the same time, I think Roshi was saying something important also. Like, you know, that's what you're meaning by don't turn away, I think.
Thank you.
Yeah, please comment on it. I don't have an answer. I just remember, I love Roshi and I remembered what he said. That's all.
Yeah. You know, I think sometimes about this question, and people sometimes ask, you know, is it okay to be angry? And I think sometimes people feel maybe it's not okay to be angry, that that somehow anger is sort of not a constructive reaction. And maybe that is sort of maybe implied in what Suzuki Roshi was saying. I don't know, but it's certainly something that you hear sometimes, that that we should try not to be angry, that we should have a different response. I don't know. I mean, first of all, at some level, I think whatever arises in us is what arises in us. And our practice is to notice it, not to push anything away. And I think you're right that it just seems natural when you see certain things in the world to give rise to anger. It feels like a very natural reaction. I suppose the question then is, what do you do with that anger? And certainly, I would say for myself, I know people who seem very attached to anger. Maybe their whole identity seems to be the things that they're angry about. And I suppose that doesn't feel very constructive. to kind of grasp that anger so tightly. But I think there are other things we can do with anger, and it can motivate us to action, and often very, very good action. Buddha sometimes talked about sort of unwholesome sources of action. I think these are usually translated as greed, hate, and delusion. So in some ways, delusion is what we've been talking about, not seeing the world clearly. So that leads to bad actions often. And if you think about it, kind of how could it not? If you're taking an action based on some false premise, it's very unlikely that it will be the right action. Greed also is pretty easy to understand. Being attached to what we don't have, or being too attached to what we do have. But hate is often a tricky one. And I suppose there's a risk of anger becoming hate. And so while I suppose anger can lead us to good actions, Buddha at least would say that hate never does. And it's a real risk that if we are too indulgent of our anger, that it can lead us to hate. And perhaps that's part of what Suzuki Roshi was warning about, getting so attached to our anger that it leads us astray. Are there other questions or thoughts? Yes, please.
I was thinking that all my life, growing up in my family, anger was not taboo. Not okay to express it. So I think just looking at the very opposite.
Yeah, thank you. I realize I'm talking about Thich Nhat Hanh a lot, and I suppose it's just because he's on my mind. But one of his teachings that I often struggled with, and I can't remember where he says this, but he has some teaching that we should always smile. I never really liked that teaching. That always seemed false. You know, sometimes I'm not happy. And I think, you know, his feeling is that like almost forcing yourself to smile, you let go of these negative feelings. But it always struck me as sort of a dangerous practice for exactly the reason you said, that you don't want to deny your feelings, deny your anger. In a sense, that's living in delusion as well, pretending not to be angry if you're angry. So I agree with you. I think our practice is not to push anything away, even hate. When we feel hate, which I think many of us do at different times, we notice that feeling. We don't scold ourselves for it. We notice it. We try to understand it. We might try not to act on it. And I suppose if we're really mindful of our anger, you know, I said sometimes it can lead us to right action, but we've all seen it lead to bad action as well, where we get so caught up in our own anger that we do things we would never do if we took a moment to think about it. But I'm not sure that suppressing is ever the right decision. Was there a question in the back? I thought I saw.
Hi, Dan, thank you. I was 10 in the Vietnam War started, and I remember my neighbor's son died. And a lot of my sister's friends ran away. You know, they didn't, acknowledge the draft. They just were conscientious objectors and they just flee to Canada. So I remember this poem that I learned and it came back just now. And I want to see if I can remember it. So it was Mama dressed in black, waits for her son to come back. He's coming home on a train. Remember, Mama, he's not the same. No hug for you, not even a hello. Remember, you said it was his duty to go. So as they bury him deep and the bugles blow, maybe the next son won't happen.
Thank you. What was there? Oh, please.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Dan. I really brought up a lot of wonderful things in your talk. Thank you for putting that together. First is, as you mentioned, attachment to, you said attachment to anger. I always remind myself that attachment is a two-way thing, right? Either you're clinging to it or you're pushing it away. Either way is attachment. Either way is problematic, just like Ben, you alluded to in your family where fear, anger was taboo, suppressed. And then the other thing that arose was regarding the smile, and how you felt, well, it's not right to force the smile or to fake the smile, but how would it feel if you'd been asked to just find the smile in you? Amidst whatever else is going on, is there still a smile there somewhere?
Thank you. It's an interesting thought. I'll have to think about it some more, but I don't mean to be too critical of his teaching. He's a great teacher. And it seemed to be a practice that worked for him. Some of his early books talk about his time, here in the States, traveling around giving lectures that were political lectures about the Vietnam War. And sometimes people in the audience would say very hurtful things. If he cared so much about his country, why wasn't he back there doing something? And he talks about the great effort he made, in a sense, not to express anger back. And it's an interesting question, practice that he had. Not exactly to suppress these things, because he clearly felt the anger, but not to express them. And it seems to have worked for him. So there are many ways of trying to notice these feelings that arise in us. Yes, please.
Dan?
Randy, we have a question here in the room, but then I can come to you.
Sure.
I've arrived at the contradiction within the teachings, and I'm sure there are a lot of contradictions, but this one is regarding suffering, what's real and what's illusory, and the teachings on body and mind. And so as we know that, like, one of the four noble truths is the truth of suffering, that suffering exists. And then we talked about the three marks of existence. And then we kind of alluded to that what is real, violence is real, and suffering is real, and our bodies are real. But then in like some other teachings, we have heard the Zen masters like Dogen and others talk about the dropping of body and mind. And in the sutras as well, for example, in the Diamond Sutra and the Sutra of Complete Enlightenment, Buddha talks about that body and mind are illusory, and there is a certain break from what is he describes as samasati, or the ultimate truth, which leads to the creation of nirvana, of samsara, where like the four elements of the senses combine to create these illusory things, such as body and mind. So the contradiction is that on one side we say there's a truth of suffering, and then we say that body and mind are illusory. So that is a contradiction that, if you could say a bit about. And the second thing is, just like while practicing, like we feel the truth of suffering, but we hear the teaching of the illusoriness of body and mind. So how to view that in practice?
I think that it's not that when Dogen wrote about dropping away of body and mind, that he meant that body and mind literally don't exist. You know, if he believed that, he wouldn't have eaten, he wouldn't have bathed, you know, he wouldn't have taken care of himself. There's no question that he thought he existed. He helped author these pure precepts that we take when we take on robes that include things like not killing. What would be wrong with killing if bodies didn't exist, if no one existed? It would be more morally suspect than killing someone in a video game. So it's very clear that Dogen thought we were real, or at least he acted as if he thought we were real. So he must have meant something else. And I think the other thing that he meant is what I was discussing, that body and mind are not these separate, unchanging things. You have a body, that's very clear. You know, if I threw this book at you, it would bounce off and it would hurt. It wouldn't just pass right through. But it's not separate from me. It's not unchanging. It's not this distinct entity apart from all others. And similarly, suffering is real. If suffering were not real, these ascetic practices that the Buddha tried, you know, wouldn't have caused pain, but pain is real. If you touch a hot stove, it hurts. And meditation doesn't change that. Meditation doesn't, at least in my experience, give us the ability to touch a hot stove and have it not hurt. So it doesn't eradicate suffering, but it provides an opportunity to overcome it, to not be consumed by it, to not be defined by it. It's sometimes hard to know what that really means, particularly when we are suffering. It can seem like it's too big to overcome. And certainly when you look in the world and see this extreme suffering that, for example, we can see today in Ukraine, it seems much too big to ever be overcome. But I think part of the Four Noble Truths is that while life is suffering, it's not only suffering. And even suffering contains those other marks of existence. Even suffering has no unchanging self. And so no matter how bad the suffering, there's always something after the suffering, beyond the suffering. I hope that's helpful. Randy, you had something you wanted to say?
Yeah, I think you touched on it there, but I was kind of just putting it, the last week or so. I mean, just feeling, sadness and anger, a whole range of emotions, and then sit with it or maybe go for a walk, whatever we do. There's this mysterious kind of, at times, a transformation. And I think you were touching on it a little bit. And I'm not sure what that is. Maybe I want an explanation of it. It won't help it at all, but it's sort of like we give it space and something happens. And I'm not sure what we touch on when we give things space, a lot of room. We're with it. I don't know if you had any more, you probably have some insights into that, of just what, I don't want a didactic, I don't think that is, but what happens? I don't know. That's my question. It's a
Well, I don't know that I know either, but I do think this practice of letting arise what arises is in some sense this practice of giving space to ourselves, giving space to the world, and noticing what arises in this space. I talked a little before about people who are very attached to anger. And I think some of the risk there is that you leave no space for anything else to arise. You see that with people who are very attached to the past, that they're so focused on things that have already occurred that they can't make space for anything new to occur. And so when we do make space, whether that's sitting in meditation or, as you said, taking a walk, all kinds of things can arise. Memories, feelings, perceptions of the world. And it is a bit mysterious. As I mentioned, out of nowhere, I had this memory triggered this week of a conversation that I hadn't thought about in decades with my grandfather. I don't know what caused that to arise. But I suppose I had made some space in kind of reflecting on things this week for these other thoughts to come up.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you have a question?
So I don't know if it's a question to and say a reflection, which is you've used that word sort of parallel meditation reflection. And it sounds like to me reaction that what the practice does to me is give me something that promotes reflection over reaction, which is hardwired, anger, hatred, fear, contempt, hatred, are built into the beast, hardwired. And for some reason, as a friend on the Zoom there, we have this great, amazing ability to count to 10. And in that, gives us the possibility to not be so shackled by our ancient history of survivalism. One last thing was the, I say it a lot, it's the, I don't know who wrote it, it has to do with old age, sickness, old age, and death. And at the end it says, my actions are my only true belongings. There is no escape from the consequence of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. Not doing anything is an action. To my mind, life is an action. So we have the possibility to reflect and through what they say, skillful means, creative means, improvisation, I don't know, to not be, to not hit. We can console or whatever.
Thanks. I think that's a very nice articulation of essentially the law of karma, of cause and effect. That, you know, when Buddha talked about karma, he didn't think about this, I think, as a moral law exactly. It wasn't true because he decreed it to be true. It wasn't like a choice. He thought about karma, I think, the way we might think about the law of gravity. You know, things fall. And they don't fall because somebody decided they should fall. That's just the way the universe works, that these masses attract each other. And he felt the same way about karma, that our actions have consequences. And it's not because he decided they should have consequences. There's no judge we can appeal to get different consequences. It's just the way the universe works, that these actions have consequences. And you can deny those consequences, but that won't get you very far. But in the end, reality will catch up.
Denying is a consequence.
Denying has its own consequences. And so yes, in the end, there's no escape. I think that's pretty much all the time we have. Thank you, those who joined us online, and thanks to all of you who came in person. It's really nice to sit in a zendo with all of you, to see all your faces on the Zoom as well. Thank you for taking some time today to practice together, perhaps help us all see the world a little more clearly.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.